The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Kratosky. On this week's program, we're looking at old institutions, new revolutions, and modern realities. Charles Arthur speaks with Yahoo President and CEO Carol Bartz. Jack Schofield grills Microsoft Office's Corporate Vice President Jeff Tepper about their latest release. And in the news, the in-studio team Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur dissect the privacy volcano that erupted this week around Facebook and Google. What is the extent of the damage caused by the public fallout? Before that, I'd like to welcome you both. Hello. Now, Charles, that the UK political ash cloud has settled across the land, what do you predict is going to happen with the Digital Economy Act?
I think that the, as I said after we'd spoken to the politicians before the election, I think that they're not going to be very minded to repeal very much. It may have been something that was put as Lib Dem policy, sort of, before the election, actually they're going to have much more important things to do, things that are actually about moving forwards rather than looking backwards and saying, oh, should we tweak this little bit of legislation? It's going to be quite a busy Queen's speech, apart from anything, because they're going to want to do all sorts of cuts to services and things. They're going to be much more concentrated on that.
There was evidence that that this may in fact happen, Jemima, because I remember Jeremy Hunt, when we were speaking with him during the election special, suggested that he would like to be the technology minister, and you got quite excited about that, but now, of course, he's not, is he?
Well, I mean, it would be exciting if only because it would show a kind of commitment to kind of pushing things forward, but actually I think Jeremy Hunt was destined for bigger things and may have got shuffled down the rankings a little because of the coalition. Given the prominence that was given to technology by a dedicated technology manifesto, it's sort of not impossible that they might come up with a new role that would sort of bring all of the make that much more coherent, I suppose, and bring all these elements together in one role, but you know, probably not.
Well, on this podcast, we'll also be looking at the real effects of political web content on public participation. How much will Web Cameron really influence Middle England? Keep listening for the latest on these stories and the rest of this week's technology news here on Tech Weekly. Here's this week's technology news stories. First, a privacy row erupted this week over two of the web's biggest content providers, Facebook and Google. Both Facebook and Google admitted that they kept private information about their users to an extent that they had not previously divulged, although Google argued that their customer data was collected in error and had not actually been used by the company. Taking a step back, Jemima, tell me what happened with Facebook.
This is just the latest in a string of sort of privacy worries from them. And this kind of issue about how much data Facebook has and how much they share that data and the user's control over what happens to that data. The first thing was back in 2006 with the newsfeed saga, if you remember that. They're now approaching 500 million users, so the order of magnitude here is considerably larger. Like 40% of the planet and 8% of online time is spent on Facebook. So I think it's still a reasonably small problem, but it has caught the interest of the EU and people like the American Civil Liberties Union.
What's the actual issue?
Well, obviously, yeah. Facebook needs to make money. And although it seems quite banal that people would post up, you know, I watched this movie and things, collectively, that's an extremely powerful resource. And so Facebook is slowly expanding the acceptable boundary, or the boundary of what we find acceptable in our personal data, and has done so right since the beginning. And now that it wants to try and monetize that by sharing that information with advertisers and retailers and people, that's why people are uncomfortable with it.
Was there any specific incident that caused the most frequent fuck up? Just simply because it seems that this erupted almost out of nowhere over the past couple of days, Charles.
Basically, it's that Facebook opened up its API even more and exposed even more of the data that people are posting on their walls or wherever, so that it could be collected through just a few lines of very simple code and spread out there all over the web. So there's a site called Open Facebook, that's not the exact address, but if you Google that, you'll hit it, which will let you do a search for the phrase, went to a strip club, And it'll find all the people who've put that into their updates at any time on Facebook.
And also that I think that Facebook still has a lot to do in making it much easier for people to rein in their data if they're not comfortable with that, because it's far too complex at the moment. There's something like 70 different settings under privacy controls.
The thing that's really kicked it off, though, is that Facebook keeps on... It's not so much that Facebook has a lot of data, because we can understand that. It's that it keeps on shifting the goalposts. Mm. You think you're in it and you sort of sign up for it and you say, okay, well, I understand what the remit of the privacy is. And then you go into it another time and it has this little message saying, hey, we changed the privacy settings a little bit, but don't worry about it. You can go and look at it here. And it's a 15-page thing. Just say agree.
Yeah,
find that it's moved.
There were some very good visualizations of this done by the New York Times and by a developer. It's all linked on PDA.
Charles, a recent Ofcom report suggested that the UK consumers, and this was just released this week actually, suggested that UK consumers are more cautious about the types of things that they're putting up on their profiles. So do you think that things like the Facebook issue have had an effect? Is this actually affecting what people are putting up on their profiles, or is this simply a zeitgeist that's going on?
Well, the Ofcom report is it's media adult media literacy report, which looks at 1,800 adults in the UK, sort of in-depth interviews. They're actually carried out in 2009, and it does them every 2 years. And it seems to suggest that people were more wary about what they did put onto social networking sites than they had done back in 2007. Now, of course, if you look back at 2007, Facebook had only just become more widely available. But I think that people are starting to understand that if you put things out there on these social network sites, they will get scarfed up by the search engines, and they will be available to people. And people realize that actually putting your marital status, who you're linked to, putting your date of birth on a website that's viewable by everyone all the time, possibly isn't a good idea.
Are there any apps out there that you can go to and find out if what actually is out there, what public content is out there at the minute?
Well, for Facebook, there's a growing number of sites which implement a technique which is simply to look at what is available on you. So there's even a sort of Facebook application which you give permission to look at your Facebook data, and it'll give you green, yellow, and red depending how much of your data is being shared. I thought I'd locked down my privacy settings pretty well, but for me, it still said no. That's pretty yellow actually, because your friends can still share stuff about you. But then again, given that all I do is just status updates about what I've written on the Guardian, I'm not so worried.
And of course, ultimately, having what your friends share things about you is part of the whole concept of Facebook, of these social networking sites anyway, isn't it? Have you had any experiences with online privacy, either on Google or Facebook, that's caught you or someone you know by surprise? Let us know on Twitter, which is our Twitter name is GuardianTW, on the blog, or, yes, on Facebook. And you can find a link to the Ofcom report that we talked about at guardian.co.uk/technology. It happened quicker than the time it takes Google to return a search result. Once the Conservative government claimed victory in the 2010 election and formed their coalition with the Liberal Democrats, the UK government's entire web presence transformed. Busy civil servants clocked up click overtime to put up information about newly elected ministers, to take down information on ministers who'd been defeated, and to introduce the new residents of Number 10 Downing Street, with David Cameron's web Cameron and the Conservatives' Flickr photo stream on prominent display. But is all this just window dressing? What is the new government's web strategy, and does it have any influence on Middle England? Well, joining me down the line is Professor Stephen Coleman, Professor of Political Communications and Director of Research at the University of Leeds. Welcome, Professor Coleman. Thank you very much for joining us.
Hello.
I just want to take a step back and ask Jemima briefly, what actually has happened on the Number 10 site?
It's really a kind of spring clean. The last time the Conservatives left and Labour came in, there was no Number 10 website. So this is the first time this has happened to this degree. But they really cleared all the content off the website so that they had a clean slate for the new Conservative government. And then they unified the account names, basically, on Twitter, YouTube, etc.
Stephen, what effect can you see of the Obama administration's use of the web? Because it seems to be the poster child, ultimately, for public engagement via the internet, using YouTube or transcripts or data.gov. How much of an actual effect have we seen on political engagement in the U.S.?
Well, I think it's very early to say. One thing that has clearly happened is that the Obama administration has used its site largely in the direction of what it calls collaborative government. Some people have called it wiki politics. The idea that you build up on the experiences, testimonies of lots of different people. And I think as a starting point, that's quite important. And there is an indication that from time to time, the public are giving the administration information in the United States that the administration just wouldn't have picked up because it's too Washington-centric, because it's too immersed in its own political bubble to really pick up some of the consequences of policies.
And how do you think that will, those policies, that effectively what we're seeing on the number 10 website is almost a cookie cutter application of the same technologies, the YouTubes, the transcripts, the data.gov.uk. How do you think people in the UK will engage with this model?
Well, I think very little of this has got to do with technology. I think it's got to do with three things. First of all, a government that is prepared to get the timing of this right. That is to say, to talk to people, not just in general and everyone and all the time, but when there is a specific area of policy dilemma that people need to come in on. Secondly, it needs to show that it can listen to and learn from people. That doesn't mean agreeing with every rant that every person produces, but it does mean showing some kind of sensitivity to hearing. And the third thing that it needs to do, and I think neither the Obama administration nor anything we've seen in the UK has quite done this so far, it needs to open up the horizontal lines, the most important lines in internet communication, and let people talk to each other. Use this big national government site as a space in which you can start getting some kind of collaborative discourse and deliberation.
Is this collaborative element really the kernel of what inspires political participation and engagement, or do you think that there are other things that are going to come into play?
There's one thing that inspires any kind of sustained political engagement, and that is efficacy. People do things if they think that they're going to get a benefit, if they think they're going to be heard, if they think they're going to be respected, if they think they're going to make contacts that will help them. Now, there is absolutely no future for a broadcasting model of internet use, which is really what we've seen from the UK government over a number of years. It's a means of going out to a mass audience, none of those horrible journalists there to ask difficult questions, and you put out your propaganda. That clearly is not something that has really had any kind of resonance with the British public. Nobody's particularly interested in it. So you're absolutely right. It's a networking potential. It's the open collaborative dialogue that is the core of what could work if politicians were to take this seriously.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Coleman. Do let us know what you think about political content online. Has it influenced you? Does any one party do it better? Drop us a line.
When we first started, it was just trying to share these clips with one another.
We saw an opportunity to empower everyone with the ability to use video online.
Hi, YouTube. We just want to say thank you. Today we have some exciting news for you. We've been acquired by Google.
Steve Chen and Chad Hurley in YouTube's fifth birthday video. The video sharing website turned 5 this week and proudly announced that it sees more than 2 billion hits per day. Jemima, it really has turned everything upside down, hasn't it?
Yeah, it's quite phenomenal, really. If you look back, I suppose the pivotal moments for YouTube were obviously being bought by Google, which really made the whole of the rest of the internet turn around and say, oh, holy cow, we really missed out on that, didn't we? 1.65 billion? Eye-watering. But Google could pay that. And as we know, in acquisitions, a company is worth what another company is prepared to pay for it. And they've got it in the bank, burning a hole in their pocket. So that was quite astonishing. And that was 2006. Seems like just yesterday, doesn't it? And the second thing is probably Viacom. This was really a test case for copyright and Viacom saying, you know, you knew when people were uploading this stuff that it was copyrighted. And that is still trundling on. It's been nearly 3 years now since that started. And YouTube has changed enormously in terms of how it handles copyright then, and got much more professional and has this kind of formal shows channel on the site, as do many broadcasters, among many other things. And it also has Content ID, which is a very clever fingerprinting content recognition tool. So even if somebody takes a slice of a piece of copyrighted content and mashes it up, it can still be detected, which is fascinating.
Well, Charles, what would you say have been the most important business moments, other than perhaps Google and Viacom? Are there others?
There was a very interesting analyst report which came out last year, about a year ago exactly, suggesting that it costs about $750 million a year to run YouTube. That was $1 million a day of bandwidth, plus servers and so on, and that the income would be about $250 million a year. And on the basis of this, he was saying, well, let's see, $750 million, taking away $250, $500 million in the hole. Google and Eric Schmidt in particular came out and said, no, our costs are nothing like that high. But he wasn't suggesting that YouTube was exactly profitable. So what it's really driving for now is to make YouTube into something which, if not directly profitable, at least isn't a huge hole down which they're pouring money all the time.
And also, I think the really big challenge for YouTube still is that there's this peculiar quandary around YouTube, which that it is everything and yet nothing. It's by far the world's biggest video sharing website, has 42% of the market. The next biggest rival is Hulu that has 3%. It's an absolute monster. And yet there's no coherent community. There's no coherent specialism there. If you look at the comments feed on any, well, you know, they're just awful,
just don't look
vitriolic
at the
comments feeds with no community and no cohesion and no sort of consistency about it.
Yeah, that's interesting because then it turns a lot of things upside down when it comes to the philosophy of what makes a successful website and what makes a successful web service.
Can it be all things to all people?
It is nothing, yet it is something.
Something like that.
Anyway, let us know what you think. What do you think has changed in the past 5 years in YouTube or, in fact, your time using the service? All the links are at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. Yahoo's president and CEO Carol Bartz was in London last month, and Charles Arthur had a few moments with her to ask about the direction of the search engine company. Charles, why was Carol in the UK?
It was to say that Yahoo had got the online rights for highlights to the Premier League, which absolutely, I mean, boy, we were excited. Yeah. But it was more really about coming over for the first time since she took over as chief executive slightly more than a year ago and seeing what the lay of the land over here in Europe is and possibly kicking a few people up the arse, which is sort of her management style. She's a woman who once said that people who leaked stuff, she would drop kick them to Mars.
Is she the Iron Lady of technology?
Well, she's not that either, you know. She's sort of quite straightforward,
aluminium,
very direct. She's sort of I don't know, what's something that appears
leather?
Sort of soft.
No, that's not nice.
Straying into entirely different sort of areas.
Anyway, Charles, you began. Charles, what did you begin by asking? The aluminium lady of technology.
I think over here it'd be aluminium. Yeah. But I'd been asking on Twitter what people wanted to know about, and the question that came back was about women in technology. So I began by asking her which other women in technology she admires.
I admire a lot of the women. I admire women for just being in technology. I'm probably the oldest woman in technology. You know, that's good or bad. So I wouldn't call out any one person. That's not fair. I admire a lot of what the younger women are doing. They're starting companies. They're really branching out. So, but no one in particular.
You wouldn't want to name that. I mean, there was Katarina Fake, for example, who set up Flickr, which of course is now part of Yahoo, though she has left. Any names that jump out for you of these younger women?
Well, Sheryl Sandberg's at Facebook. I really liked the woman that was at Ning. I just can't remember her name right now. You know, the problem when you ask that, then you miss somebody, and then that's not nice, so.
Do you find that the emphasis that's put on your being a woman, being a woman CEO at a tech company, do you find that annoying or sort of distracting?
You know, I don't pay much attention to that anymore. It's been going on for so many years. But on the other hand, it is important to continue to pave the way for the young women we were just talking about, because it shouldn't seem that it's so odd.
With regards to your tenure now at Yahoo, are there things you've learned at Yahoo that you wish you had known when you were running Autodesk?
Not yet.
And in regards to Yahoo again, can you confirm that the reason why Yahoo turned down the approach, I mean, I know this precedes your time there, but the reason why Yahoo turned down the approach from Microsoft was because it had its own internal forecasts about
where its share price and its value would be, which were way above Microsoft's approach, and even though those are completely shown to be completely wrong?
You know, I actually don't know. I have particularly not wanted to know.
Why is that? You don't?
Because, first of all, when I've been involved in these kind of things before, and every side has a different opinion as to what happened. The bankers will have a different opinion than the buying side, than the sold side, than the... And so I didn't have enough time to go ask every side. I'm looking forward. Mm-hmm. So I honestly don't know.
Right. And the mobile internet, Apple has an offering there. Microsoft obviously has an offering there. Google has an offering there. The thinking being, I think, that if you control how people are going onto the internet via mobile, that you have greater control of what happens, how the whole mobile world looks. Yahoo doesn't have an offering there in terms of you don't have a phone platform, you're not the default search on any of those platforms. Doesn't that weaken where you are?
I actually don't think so, because I think a lot of these companies are at war with each other, and they're not going to want... I don't think all the telcos are going to want Google as the default search. I think a Yahoo stack on Android, which we have coming, will be an excellent. Do you think Apple really wants to have a Google search?
Well,
probably
are you,
not.
Are you talking to them about it?
That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that it's one thing to have an operating system. It's another thing to win all the business, because you put other interesting application stacks on top of an operating system.
Another question from Twitter is, why are so many really talented people leaving Flickr, and are you worried about that?
We have talented people coming and going all the time. I mean, it's... people like to... You know, the interesting thing is, do you remember a company called Fairchild Semiconductor? And do you remember how that company actually sort of spawned the Valley? Mm-hmm. Yahoo's 15 years old. If you want anybody with internet experience, you have to come to Yahoo. Mm-hmm. I mean, and so it's actually kind of prideful that we look around and see many of these companies. In fact, I was at a meeting last week. Actually, it was a meeting of young women in technology, and I'd say half of them came from Yahoo.
But the Fairchild story didn't end happily, did it? I mean,
Yeah, but they lived on for a long time. I mean, look at... maybe I'll use HP. I mean, you see HP veterans all over the place. Everybody's saying just because somebody leaves. Did it ever occur that some of these people might want to have been asked to leave?
Charles Arthur interviewing Carol Bartz from Yahoo. Charles, just... briefly, take a step back and explain the Fairchild Semiconductor that you were talking to Carol.
Well, Fairchild was formed by a breakaway group of eight people who created really the first big successful chip making company in the US, and it sort of flared up briefly. It was incredibly effective. It was very profitable, and it then sort of started shooting people out who would go off and found, you know, and do big things in semiconductors. But the trouble was that Fairchild never quite became the company that really drove it. You know, Intel took that over. Motorola, when it was a chip maker, took that over, and Fairchild is sort of continued. It's actually 50 years old now, and it's still there. But, you know, if you were to say to someone, so, Fairchild Semiconductor, they'd never have heard of it. And, I think the comparison for Yahoo to make that comparison to Fairchild, I understand why she did it, because, you know, she's known about Fairchild because it's a Valley thing forever. But it's sort of indicative, you know, that I think that Yahoo doesn't, I don't think, really want to end up like Fairchild. You don't want to be the place from which all the really great people came. You want to be the place all the really great people are at.
Well, she seemed awfully prickly in her responses to you, Charles. I don't know if that's because she's made of iron, or if in fact you were onto something with some of your questions.
I think it's actually just her style. You know, she sounds prickly because she had just endured being asked various questions for half an hour by journalists, some of whom were a little better informed than other ones. And I think that's just sort of how she comes across. But you know, this is someone who says she likes to fire people first thing in the morning, because she says, you don't want to be sitting there, you know, waiting to the end of the day. You don't want to be thinking, well, I got to fire Joe at 5 o'clock. So people who are asked to breakfast with Carol Bartz are young, who know they're in trouble.
I think that's only fair, to be honest. But you spent most of your time speaking with her about the satellite companies, about the people, you know, who were at Yahoo, who created great things, or the things that Yahoo has bought. Now, do you think that that suggests that she admits that Yahoo is no longer a search engine company, that it's a content company, as Bobby Johnson was talking about probably about a year ago?
Well, she was saying as much, actually. She really wasn't positioning Yahoo as a search company. She was positioning it very much as a display advertising company. She was saying loads of people come here every day to check email. You know, we're a big, big site for that. Loads of people read content, and Yahoo, you know, has a lot of people generating content for it. So actually, that was part of what she was over for, was to meet all sorts of advertising executives, you know, the sort of the modern day Don Drapers, to say, you know, Yahoo is a great place if you want to advertise.
And does this mean that she admits defeat against the mighty Google?
I don't know if she would ever have thought of it as being a fight like that, because when she came to Yahoo, in that sense, the fight was already over. So she wasn't thinking, right, let's get this company back on its feet and have a big fight with Google. That's not really how one goes about business, if you're sensible in the internet. You look at actually what are your strengths, and you say, okay, play to your strengths and really, really make those strong. Trying to beat Google in the search business is a fool's game these days, but trying to beat Google on the display advertising business, well, that's something Yahoo can do.
Jemima, Charles didn't have the chance to ask Carol about the rumors that they're thinking about buying Foursquare, the hugely popular geolocation game. What's the meat on the bones of this rumor?
Well, it's quite an old rumor now. It's about a month old, but it was that they were having discussions that valued Foursquare at 100 million. And then, of course, it all evaporated, as these things often do. Dennis Crowley, who's the founder of Foursquare, said there had been loads of rumours and people were just making stuff up. But then he would say that because people always do. And they were also having discussions at the time with VCs that valued the firm $80 million. So, well, it's $20 million between friends. But he was having to make the fairly typical startup decision about whether you take investment and carry on with what you're doing or whether you get bought by Yahoo. TechCrunch described it as the place that startups go to die, which is a little unkind, but not entirely untrue. I'd be quite sad if it got bought by Yahoo, I think.
Yahoo have been playing around in this geolocation space for a while, though, haven't they?
Yeah, they have, yeah.
It's not an uncharted territory for
them. It's not uncharted territory, and what they did was establish Fire Eagle under the brilliant direction of Tom Coates, who's a Brit, who's just left, but that's another story. Fire Eagle was a very clever idea to be a location aggregator. So rather than the standalone service, it would be one service. You could update your location. It would update all the services that linked into that. Fantastic idea. But perhaps a little ahead of its time, I think, and that's a bit of a shame.
Well, you can read more on Carol Bartz's visit to the UK at guardian.co.uk. The computer editor of The Guardian, Jack Schofield, recently attended the business launch of Microsoft's latest desktop application, Office 2010. There he met with Jeff Teper, the corporate vice president of the SharePoint team at Microsoft, who created the technology. The team were keen to open up the process of development in this latest iteration of the world-leading software, ensuring that the markup language was easy to access, that it could be integrated with web platforms like Facebook, for example, and could be accessed via the cloud. Although the evolution of the new .docx format has not been without criticism, including criticism from yourself, Charles, Jack started talking about the move towards the cloud for this version of Office 2010, including a version that's going to appear as Facebook Docs.
We're offering people Office as a great experience on the PC, on the web, and the browser. And so we'll offer the Office web applications through SharePoint Online and Windows Live. In addition, we've got some experiments going on, other ways we can deliver those, and the work with Facebook is one of those experiments.
One of the things that has created quite a lot of controversy recently is the move to the new OpenXML file format. And yeah, you've had a bit of a kicking there on the web about how quickly you're moving. Can you update us on progress there?
Sure. Office today supports about 20 different file formats. It's very important to us to interoperate with a range of systems and give people a choice what the default file format is. So we support the ODF format, the traditional binary formats, and the OpenXML format. We've worked with the standards organizations on those things. As the standards bodies incorporate new feedback on OpenXML, we'll incorporate it in future versions of Office. The file format for this version of Office is fully published, documented. Thousands of software developers interoperate with it today.
Right. Do we know how long it's going to take before all of the suggestions that were made during the standardization are actually incorporated into the Office code?
We're still engaged on that feedback. There are some suggestions that are quite good suggestions, but it'll take more time to include, and there's other suggestions where we need to discuss it, where there's some trade-offs, be it backward compatibility or functionality. So it's not in the near term, but we're very actively working on that process.
I'm obviously a very keen Office user and have been for decades, unfortunately. I used multi-tool Word for DOS when it came out, so
excellent.
I go back a long way. And even I am rather slow to upgrade. I've still got 2003 on my laptop, I've got 2007 on my desktop, I've got 2010 on a spare machine. You're in an elevator. How do you persuade somebody, even somebody who thinks Office 2010 is great, how do you persuade them to actually upgrade?
Well, one of the things we try to do is try to look at what people do. So people who write a lot are very excited about the new capabilities in Word to navigate long documents, and so we could spend time talking about that. There's a lot of people who spend time on social networks. The new Outlook social connector that connects not only to SharePoint, but to things like Facebook and LinkedIn will save those sort of heavy social networking users a lot of time. There's people who spend many hours a day creating presentations, and there's a set of stunning new features for creating rich multimedia presentations in PowerPoint and sharing those on the web. So there's something for everyone in the new version of Office. The other thing that's exciting is now is a great time to go buy a new modern laptop running Windows 7, running Office 2010. I think anybody who does that today will be dramatically more happy than they were with a 5-7-year-old PC. So Office 2010 will run on the existing PCs, but I think if people who are running a new modern PC with Windows 7 will be even happier.
So it's the old double whammy of get your new operating system and your new copy of Office.
It couldn't hurt. And if you're running 2003, I think you'll be a lot happier once you upgrade.
Jack Schofield speaking with Jeff Tepper. Charles, you were shaking your head there. What are your criticisms of Office 2010?
Why does anyone need it? That's the question which I think is not actually really answered. It's a sort of, well, hey, everyone else is getting it. You got to get it. And I've not, in what I've read about it, I've not seen anything apart from perhaps 64-bit Excel. Okay, if you need 64-bit spreadsheets, if you're at NASA or something and you need to have that, then sure, go ahead. There's collaborative editing, but then again, there's lots of things which will let you do collaborative editing in other forms. Google Docs is sort of good enough for collaborative editing. We use it to do the Tech Weekly script.
It could just be to confuse the PR world by adding peculiar extensions onto the end of the .doc file name so that nobody can open stuff they send out.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you about this, Charles. What are these .docx's? This open XML format that Jack was talking about.
Yeah, well, that came with Office 2007, which is effectively a zipped XML file, so that although it looks like a single file, it's actually a zipped up folder. And if you dig around inside it, you'll find you'll find the plain version that there used to be before in there. And there's been a lot of argument about the implementation of the OpenXML standard, because that was standardized. Microsoft pushed that to be an ISO standard, but it hasn't implemented all of the standard in Office 2010, and it's unlikely that it will be implemented for another two versions. So you're possibly talking about Office 2015. 2015 before it's fully implemented. That is the standard which Microsoft pushed itself.
Thinking about the social networking implications, this is something that they've been trumpeting. Is this an innovation? Is this an experiment that is coming to pass?
That's just what they've got to do, though, isn't it? You know, that would be the first thing people said if they hadn't included it. It's a sort of no-brainer, really.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because Microsoft bought a chunk of Facebook, don't forget, at the end of, I think, 2008. So, of course, this is a nice way for them to implement it. But do you really want to be sharing your office documents on Facebook when we've been having all the privacy row? You know, what's the next step in its privacy thing won't be to open up all your office documents to everyone. And I don't quite get how working on a social network like Facebook fits together with working on your very serious office documents that have been Microsoft formatted.
LinkedIn, maybe.
Well, possibly. But again, I don't see what the compelling business case is. You know, it's a great compelling business case for Microsoft because it gets lots of money from it.
We're going to have to leave this here, and you can read up on the history of the Microsoft Office 2010 release at guardian.co.uk/technology. That's all for this week. Many thanks to our studio guests, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur, and to Jack Schofield on the road. Our producer this week was Scott Cawley. I'm Alex Krotowski. There are many ways to keep in touch with us, including our Twitter feed, GuardianTW. You can also find us on Facebook and do comment on the blogs. All the details are at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. We're back next week. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.